Looking to save some money on this year's fuel oil bills? Stay tuned for the Handy Guys podcast.
Welcome to the Handy Guys podcast, where we work together to complete that honey-do list, featuring answers to your questions and head-to-head tool challenges. Let's get started with the show with the Handy Guys, Brian and Paul.
Welcome to the Handy Guys podcast. This is episode number 36, and we're the Handy Guys, and we're continuing our series on saving some money around the home in regards to the heating of your home.
That's right. Energy savings. And we're going to focus on some insulation and alternative heating and thermostats and things like that today.
Yeah, I mean, the heating season is just around the corner, and unfortunately, the prices have gone up. If you heat your home, in an average home this year, if you heat your home with oil, for instance, it could cost you around $4.50 a gallon. If so, you're looking at around $3,200 a year this year in heating bills. If you use natural gas and you pay about $1.55 per therm, that would cost you about $1,550 a year in heating bills. So you're paying about half. But it's still a lot of money. So maybe we can get some of those costs down this year.
Yep.
All right. Well, before we do that, of course, let's hand out our contact information. Brian, how can you contact us?
You can always call us at 615-676-0877. Or on our website, we have a contact form and you can fill that out. Or you can just email us at handyguyspodcast.com.
And we'd love to hear from you. We've received several emails in the last couple of weeks on responses to various topics we've covered. Love to hear from our listeners. Also, check out our website, www.handyguyspodcast.com.
Of course, right.
You can check out our store. We haven't really talked about that in a while, but we still have many of the tools that we've tested sitting out there in the store, and they're still great tools.
Yep, and you can just search for something, too. It doesn't need to be one of the items we've featured.
Right. Okay, today, before we get to the heating issues, I wanted to respond. We had Phil call in again. He was the one that called in last week about his garage door, and I just wanted to play what he had to say.
I have a follow-up question from last week's question about my garage doors. Now, I was surprised when you suggested the insulation as well, because the big box store was trying to get me to buy insulated doors, and I figured they were just trying to up the price of what I would be getting. The reason why I don't think it's the right solution for me, but maybe you can change my mind. I have a garage that's attached to the house, and there's no insulation in that garage whatsoever, not in the roof, not in the walls, nowhere. So I was thinking that I probably don't need any insulation in the doors because it's not going to provide give me anything more than there's no point in insulating the doors if the walls and the roof aren't doing it anyway. But do you have any thoughts on that? Are there some advantages for sound insulation or something like that? Anyway.
All right. And Phil had a good point. We talked about how it's important to insulate your garage door, but that was assuming that your garage is connected to your house and you have other insulated walls inside that garage. And Phil makes a good point. If his garage is not already insulated, maybe only the adjoining wall to his house is insulated, but it has other external walls that are not, does he need to insulate the door?
I would say yes, and I would insulate the garage, but that's also because right. I have a workshop in the garage, and it gets kind of cold out there in the winter.
Sure, but normally I would think Phil's on the right track, probably not worth paying to insulate the garage door. If the rest of the garage is not insulated, it's going to be cold anyway. So you're right, Phil. Go ahead and just look for maybe an aluminum door to replace the rotted out wood ones. All right. Now, we have one other thing. A listener wrote in and sent us a link to an EPA site, which has some information about what to do with CFLs. We talked last week about compact fluorescent lights and how you can save money on them and how I like them and Brian doesn't. But we both said
thanks, Paul.
There's a problem. If they get broken, what do you do because they contain mercury? Well, there's a good website that explains what to do. It's an EPA site if you break one of these lights, and we'll post the link on our website, so check it out. But basically, the bottom line is if one of these lights breaks, you need to open the windows remove pets, children, and others from the vicinity. So if any mercury comes into the air, I suppose it will get it, you know, out of the air. You're not breathing
it. Dissipated and yeah. distributed and whatever.
That's right. And they also provide some specifics on what to do if it's broken on carpet or if it's broken on a hardwood floor. It's some very simple instructions. So you can, you know, obviously you can either broom it up and or vacuum it, and then you take the bag that you vacuumed with and put it in a Ziploc or into a glass jar. So they have specific instructions, and really what you want to do is remove the material and put it in a sealed container.
All right. Well, thanks to our listeners for getting us up to speed on that, and the link will be on our website.
All right. Now let's move on. Next on the Handy Guys, we're going to talk about how to save a few dollars on your fuel bill.
You're listening to the Handy Guys Podcast.
Okay, Brian.
Yes.
For the topic of the day, I don't want to spend $3,000 this winter on my heating bill. Of course, I don't have fuel oil, so that's nice. So maybe I'm only paying $1,500, $2,000 in the heating season, depending on how cold it is. But maybe is there anything I can do to save some money off of even my gas bill?
Well, I was talking to someone just today, and they said, hey, I've got insulation blown in my attic. And they were describing the joists in the attic that make up the ceiling of the second floor of the house. And he said to me, you know, there's insulation filled in about halfway up the depth of those joists.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's a no-brainer. Fill it up all the way to the top.
Absolutely. And you can, you know, rent the blower. And you can get the material from your home center
and just blow it in there. And if you want to do it on the cheap, you can just buy the bags and use a leaf rake and fluff it up yourself and just kind of spread it around.
Absolutely. And if it's not a huge area, you can just rake it in there. You just grab the bags, lift them up in there. Now, it's important to understand that, you know, insulating your attic is it's the most important area in your home you can insulate, because heat rises. And if it's escaping through the ceiling, then you're going to lose a lot of heat. And lose a lot of money.
That's right. But you also want to make sure you don't, if you have vents, soffit vents, you don't block them.
That's right. You definitely want to keep the roof vented for the reason we discussed, I believe, last week or the week before. And there's some various different materials that you can use to blow into the attic. You can, there's fiberglass, rock wool, or cellulose. And they each have about between 2.5 and 3.7 R value per inch of fill.
So which one's the best?
Well, the cellulose tends to have a little bit of a higher R value than, say, the fiberglass.
And it's not going to be as itchy either.
That's true. I think I have, I don't know if my attic has the rock wool or the fiberglass, but it doesn't seem to be too itchy. But, you know, you're not working with it like you do with the bats.
That's true. And so it's no problem mixing that. So if you've already got rock wool and you want to put in cellulose, or you've got fiberglass and you want to put in rock wool, you can mix those together. It's not going to hurt anything. So, compare your prices, see what you're going to get the best bang for the buck, and go for the higher R value if the prices are the same.
Right. And you can also get the bats, and you can put another layer of bats on of the fiberglass bats, the pink or the yellow or the white bats that you can see at the home centers. And they're about 3.2 R value per inch. But the interesting thing about those is that you have to put them either between your joists, or if you're putting another layer, you run them on top perpendicular to the previous layer.
Right, right.
But they still, even though their R value is similar, they're harder to fill in all the gaps. So
that's right. You got to make sure they're up tight against each other. And when you do that with the fiberglass, bats, you don't want to use a faced insulation, because some of that insulation is either totally encapsulated in plastic, or it has a craft paper barrier.
Yeah.
You don't use that.
All right. So that's the attic. And if you're in an older home, you might want to attempt to fill, you know, maybe there's some uninsulated walls, and there's some different systems you can do. You know, sometimes they come, you can either do it from the outside when you're getting your house new siding, or you can do it from the inside where they punch holes between each joist bay and they, you know, spray something in there, a foam or one of these loose fills. Obviously it's disruptive to your home.
And that's right. So, there's a lot of repair work to do after the fact.
Right.
So that's a much more involved process. We're not going to get into all the details on the show, but there's definitely contractors out there that can help you with that.
you're in a newer home, there's not much else you can do than insulating the attic and also maybe looking for other holes and gaps throughout the home. A new or older home, you look at your windows, whether you have good windows and seals around them, whether you need, you know, to improve that. You can certainly make a big savings in fuel energy by replacing older windows with newer ones, but you're gonna pay the price up front. So that's a difficult decision to make. But what are some other things that we can do, some practical ideas in to save some money? You know, how about just turning down a thermostat?
That's a great one. And, we've done a little bit of research for our listeners here on do setback thermostats pay? And we had a listener call in with a question about that.
That's right, Brian. We did. We had a listener who contacted us about what to do about setbacks, saving money by turning down the thermostat automatically.
That's
what a setback is. And in his case, he had electric baseboard.
That's right. And he had thermostats in each room. And those type of setups are usually what's called line voltage. So those baseboard electric heat, you have 110 or 220 volts actually coming right up to the thermostat and then from the thermostat down to the baseboard, just like you'd have a wall switch running standard line voltage to a light. And there's thermostats specifically made for that type of setup. And you can get setback or programmable thermostats. So you can say, you know, I want it to go turn my heat from 68 to 65, from midnight to 6 a.m. And from, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. I want to turn it back.
Right.
And the problem is, I looked at some of the pricing on those. Cheapest ones I could find were about $35-$40. More common ones were maybe about 60 and 100, even some for $150. So if you have one of those for every single room of your house, that's going to get really expensive.
Right, and that's for the line voltage thermostats. Even the standard thermostats that you use in your central system may be $50 to $100.
Right, but you only need one or two of them.
Right, exactly.
Instead of, 10 or 12 of them.
Exactly. You only need one or two, and they make a lot of sense to do that. So if you work, you can just have it automatically set it down and you get a significant savings if it's set down for 8 hours so a day.
Now, for that person who called in, I was thinking, well, wouldn't it be neat if you could control all of those thermostats centrally, all of those individual ones? And I tried to do a little research and there was a company that made what's called an X10 programmable line thermostat.
Back to our home automation.
That's right. So, and what you could do is actually use a PC and a controller and some other stuff and set up some schedules and have them turn on and off. But that company is no longer making them anymore. Maybe someone's going to come out with a new version of that. I don't know. But so in that caller's case, I would say, just turn back the thermostats in rooms you don't use very often. That's one of the neat advantages of that type of system, is that if you have a bedroom you don't use or something like that, you can turn that all the way down to 55 and not even heat that room.
Yeah, those kids' rooms, they don't need any heat.
Just give them an extra blanket.
Yeah, there you go. And, so for the standard central heating, then the setbacks make a lot of sense. But, Brian, how much can we expect to save if we set that thing back during the day while we're at work? You have some numbers on that?
I do. I contacted the U.S. Department of Energy and got some stats here for us. So here we go. You can save about 5% to 15% per year on your heating bill by turning your thermostat back 10 to 15 degrees for 8 hours.
Okay, so you have to do a significant setback during that day. You can't just set it down, a few degrees. It's what was it?
10 to 15 degrees.
Wow.
So if you normally have it at 68, you're putting it back to 58, 55 for 8 hours a day.
Right.
I don't know if I'd want it back at 55 at night.
No, that would be too cold. And in fact, if you're a senior citizen or older, there are some problems when you have it set too cold. For some people, it can introduce various health problems and health risks.
Right. So you gotta do it sensibly. For me personally, my wife is in and out of the house all day. She doesn't work full time. You know, our schedules are kind of goofy, so we never know. A programmable won't work for us because...
Come on, just set it down. But if you do, what I recommend there for you, Brian, is if you're going to do it, get the set back, but you need one of those lock boxes that go over top
Right, I can padlock it.
Yeah, because I have the same problem. If I do that, you know, it's going to leave an unhappy wife.
Right.
So, you know, the other thing, you know, that's interesting, you know, at night, there are some different things you can try to do, but it's hard to figure out the cost benefit. You know, you could turn it way down, but then you can use an electric blanket, but then that uses power. And so... Right.
Well, you could use, you know, just, you know, a couple extra blankets. I mean, that's, you know, it's nothing wrong with that, and wear some flannel pajamas or whatever, you know, whatever.
And then some people use space heaters. You know, again, if it's maybe one room of the house, that might make some sense.
Yeah, but space heaters tend to be expensive to operate. They're going to be electric,
yes.
Usually. Back when I was a kid, the energy crunch in the 70s, kerosene heaters were real popular. And
And so were our house fires.
Right, exactly. So I haven't seen too many people putting kerosene heaters in their house anymore, but they're still available. But kerosene was real cheap.
Right. So, okay. So up next, we're going to talk about, you know, a change of direction here.
Okay.
What are some wildly different, you know, directions we can go with our fuel? What are some different ways we can heat the house and save even more money, if possible? Coming up next. All right, we're back. And Brian, in this month's Fine Home Building, they had an interesting article on wood stoves and pellet stoves and just using wood overall to heat your house. Now, a lot of homes have fireplaces, especially, you know, homes built in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, maybe you're thinking, well, you know what, this winter I'll just get some wood and we'll burn wood. Is that a solution for some folks?
No.
It's not.
No, I had, you know, the house I had before the one I'm in now, I had a masonry fireplace, a brick fireplace. House was built in right after World War II, 1946, I think it was, and had glass doors. You know, we'd burn a fire in there. It was nice. It would
look good.
It would look good. Smell good. Sure. The living room was warm. You know, within 10 foot of the fireplace, 15 foot of the fireplace, maybe.
Occasionally, the you know, catch on fire around the paneling
the
fireplace,
nothing like that. But then the you know, the
no
back bedrooms
fires.
Of the house would get colder. Why would they get colder?
Ah, that's a good question, Brian. I expect that they get colder because that fireplace of yours needed a lot of air to burn.
Yes, it did.
And fire needs air. And in fact, it was probably needed so much air that it was pulling air through your house and right through the windows and those, you know, everywhere it could get air. And so you had air being drawn in through your house.
Exactly right. Because there's a lot of that fire is burning up that air for combustion. That's one problem. So it's taking that air that you've heated in the rest of the house and burning that and sending it up the chimney.
Right.
And it's also, in my case, it was 20 feet away from the thermostat. So that thermostat was reading warmer.
Sure.
Therefore, the heat would not kick on.
Right.
And then the bedrooms and part of the house that was the furthest away, you know, never got any heat.
Okay, but I know that there are some solutions to this problem. That is, we need more efficient ways of burning wood.
That's right.
Than those open fireplaces.
Right. So you've got the article in front of you, but off the top of my head, you've got inserts that are sealed inserts. So you're sealing that combustion chamber,
mm-hmm.
and you're able to control the amount of combustion air and also where that combustion air comes from. So they can actually be set up to bring air from outside to facilitate the combustion.
That's right.
And they're sealed, meaning they don't take air from inside the house. And so they can supplement the heat. And wood is relatively inexpensive. It can even be free if you're willing to work for it.
Right. So you can put in an insert. If you have a big enough hearth, you can actually put a wood stove right in there. and seal out and connect it to your chimney system.
I think Ben Franklin had it right. You know, he invented the potbelly stove, right? And the idea there was it was in the middle of the room versus being on the outside wall.
Sure.
So then it would radiate heat 360 degrees. Now, these stoves you're talking about would just sit on the hearth and vent out the existing chimney.
Right.
But
what's cool about the newer wood stoves is that they're EPA certified, which means they don't burn off a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of pollutants that come out of them.
That's right.
And the reason is because they are so efficient, they literally burn off their own combustion.
That's right. All that
particles
smoke gets burned.
And smoke gets burned because it circulates the air within the stove and it burns up the gases.
Yeah,
and so it's amazing. So not only are they much cleaner than, say, a wood stove that came out in the 1970s, but as a result, they're much more efficient and use a lot less air and heat a lot better.
Right. They're going to heat hotter and they're going to use less wood, too.
Exactly. They're going to burn slower. And so you have the opportunity here then of using a wood stove, maybe use a standalone stove somewhere in your house, use one that's in the hearth, or use a good insert, an EPA certified insert in your current fireplace, which you have custom made for your fireplace.
And you can also, if you don't want to be dealing with lugging wood and so forth, but you want that look, there are actually inserts. If you've got a masonry fireplace, you can actually get a gas burning insert that can also produce some heat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we go back to the basement series, I put a gas stove in my basement, and I actually picked that one. The company that makes that makes those high efficiency stoves that you were just talking about that can, you know, sealed combustion, EPA certified, catalytic converters, and the whole nine yards, but they have gas versions of those. And you can see a picture of one I put in on that one of the basement posts.
Now, the only downside of, the upside of the wood burning is you get a little bit more of the look of a wood fireplace if you can see through the glass. But the alternative is you can use like a pellet stove where there are wood pellets that you buy and you can load up a hopper so it can burn for a long time. But unfortunately, it looks like it's a, I don't know, what would you say this picture looks like, Brian, there? I'll hold it up for you. You know,
we'll have to scan it now that we're talking about
it. It looks like, you know, you got two jets. It's like a, you know, like a gas fireplace.
It almost looks like a gas fireplace, yeah.
But that's how it burns the wood pellets. And if you,
it looks like a kiln, like a flame that might be in a kiln or something.
Exactly. So you don't really get that look of a fireplace. And that's in this month's Fine Home Building. If you want to check it out, it's a good article on burning wood. One of the things they mention is that even in these days of high heat, if you had a wood stove that could heat your entire home, and of course it's difficult to do that, even if you get an efficient one, to put it in a place where it'll heat your whole home. But if you did, even if you had to buy all of your wood, you know, cords of wood, using the same numbers we talked about earlier, an average home, you know, we talked about $1,500 for gas, $3,200 for oil, it would cost about $950 for wood. And again, that's assuming you paid for your wood. You didn't find a tree, you didn't cut your own wood or anything like that.
And those prices for wood, I think our national averages, what was it, about $190 a cord?
A cord, that's right.
Right. And how much is a cord, Paul?
That's a cord? Well, it depends.
No, it doesn't depend. It's a very specific measurement.
No, it depends on what kind of wood it is.
No, it doesn't.
I'm just kidding.
A cord is a pile of neatly stacked wood, 4 foot deep, 4 foot high, and 8 foot wide.
It's coming back to me now.
Okay.
I haven't worked with wood in quite a while.
And when you have it delivered, you pay more to have it stacked.
That's right. And the important critical item about wood, Brian, is to use a good variety of wood that you burn.
A hardwood.
Absolutely. You want it to be a hardwood. If it's a softwood, there's moisture and it becomes very inefficient. Plus, it dirties up your chimney.
It builds up creosote in the chimney and all that.
And the other thing is, it's just as important as the variety of wood, and maybe even more important, is that it's been properly dried.
That's right. Typically, a year under a tarp is about what you need.
Exactly, because if there's any moisture in that wood, then again, it becomes less efficient, and you're burning off moisture in the wood. So that's one alternative. There's others, Brian. There's solar, still pretty pricey, even though they're trying to come down in price, and that's more to heat hot water or for electricity. And there's geothermal, which is a great solution.
Right, I was talking to someone online about that, And they were looking at, I think about $4,000 a year for oil heat. And so he was considering putting in a geothermal system that was, I think his numbers off the top of my head, it was about $12,000 to put the system in, and it was going to run about $800 a year to operate.
Well,
is what he was looking at.
Well, so, you know, it's pricey to get it in, but you can certainly do pretty well once you get it
in. Yeah, so he's going to recoup that in about 5 or 6 years.
Right. Not a bad deal.
No.
Anything else? Any other alternatives here for heating your home? You know, like space-age polymers or anything like that? You know, a flux capacitor or something?
No, we haven't invented that yet.
All right, so that's about it. If you have ideas on saving money, we'd love to hear from them, and we'll talk about them in a future podcast. That's about all we got this week,
other than upcoming, empty wallets. We definitely have a... we're going to be looking at a whole home electricity monitor, and we're going to be evaluating that.
Oh, that's a good point. We mentioned it last week.
That's right, and they're on their way, Paul. I don't know when we're going to get them, but it looks really cool. It hooks right up to your meter, and it'll tell you on a per-hour basis how much electricity you're using. So
it's easy to install, not that expensive, and finally, something I've been looking for, a simple device that tells me exactly how much I'm spending per hour, per minute, you know.
So that's on a future show.
That's coming up, and we'll do that in a future show. Otherwise, we'll be back next week. We're the Handy Guys.
I'm Brian.
I'm Paul. We'll see you next week.
Bye.